I'm Darren.
And I'm Esther.
And this is Second Sunday, a podcast about Black queer folk finding, keeping, and sometimes losing faith.
This season's full of candid conversations. We're talking to theologians, artists, activists, and community members living at the intersections of faith, spirituality, and identity.
The saints ain't ready for this,
but we're still going to talk about it.
Second Sunday. Find it wherever you get podcasts.
Second Sunday is a Cube original podcast and is part of the PRX Big Questions Project.
It's been called the single largest humanitarian crisis on Earth.
Even before the conflict, Sudan's health system is known to be quite fragile and weak.
I'm Marco Werman. Today on the show, meeting medical needs in war-torn Sudan, where nearly 80% of the hospitals are deemed not functional. And in Gaza, a daytime pause in fighting to let in food and water is critical right now, as we hear from this aid worker.
There is an utterly, utterly lethal lack of water on the Gaza Strip.
Plus, in rural Japan, people are trying to preserve a unique art form that's been part of their identity for generations. And a debut for an ensemble at the Grand Ole Opry, fusing two sounds that seem worlds apart.
I don't see any difference between when I sing Wayfaring Stranger or a Bilawal Raga from India.
All that and more today here on The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for making it this Monday. Recent events in Sudan have the country sliding toward a dangerous new precipice. The paramilitary group known as the Rapid Support Forces has been trying to sack the city of El Fasher. Washington's ambassador to the UN, Linda Thomas-Greenfield, described what was happening at a press conference on Friday.
The people of El Fasher are trapped. They're surrounded by heavily armed RSF. Food, water, medicine, and other essentials are drying up. Famine is setting in.
The situation is so dire that the UN Security Council passed a resolution to end the siege. Here's Thomas Greenfield again.
This resolution could not come at a more precarious moment.
A prolonged stalemate has caused the civilian situation to erode. This is the single largest humanitarian crisis on the planet, is how USAID Administrator Samantha Power described things in Sudan currently. 12 million people are displaced because of this conflict, and 750,000 people could face catastrophic food insecurity by September. Meanwhile, an estimated 80% of hospitals in Sudan are not functional. The profound medical need is what we're going to talk about with Berhanu Waka. He's the Sudan Country Director for Medical Teams International, a humanitarian organization focused on delivering medical care to crisis areas.
As you have rightly stated, this is one of the largest internal displacement crises globally. Over 9 million people internally displaced and almost 2 million crossed international borders. And 5 million people just one step away from famine. Generally in Sudan, 4.9 million people have impaired health access due to the conflict in Sudan. That's what medical teams is trying to support.
Yeah, I mean, the numbers are really shocking. Just to underscore the concern around this vocabulary of famine and catastrophic food insecurity, are we talking of the possibility of people starving to death?
If there is no timely intervention, we'll be looking at an actual famine situation, particularly over 100 localities or villages assessed to be in the state of emergency, which is just one step away from catastrophic or famine state.
What appear to be the causes of famine and malnutrition right now? Is it food delivery? Is it abandoned, damaged farm fields, the fighting? What is the obstacle?
In many cases, I've seen people being subject to, you know, siege-like conditions where civilians are, you know, prevented from moving up freely. There has been quite substantial damage on infrastructure, including 80% of the health facilities damaged, incapacitated. Manufacturing of, you know, medicines, you know, suspended, and then of course, you know, the lack of access, access both for end use humanitarian actors like medical teams, you know, to support the communities. And also access to those service delivery points have been substantially impaired. And I think all of this put together over a year has put the people of Sudan in this situation that we are looking at. And of course, in addition to all of this, Sudan crisis has been really a forgotten crisis. Funding has been quite difficult. Resources are quite scarce. Any effort, you know, to expand programs and services is met with critical funding shortages that many organizations, including medical teams, are facing.
As a result of all this, Burhanu, have you or your staff seen more children, for example, with symptoms of malnutrition?
And of course, you know, various reports, including the ones that, you know, medical teams has finalized recently in Khartoum State and in other areas, children and other vulnerable groups like pregnant and lactating women are going through malnutrition, you know, at the moment.
That estimate you mentioned a moment ago, that 80% of hospitals are non-functional, that is especially concerning. Do you even have access to supplies and some kind of facility to do your job?
So even before the conflict, Sudan health system is known to be quite fragile and weak. And of course, the conflict has weakened the health system, you know, further with, as you've said, over 70, over 80% of the health facilities being damaged, and also the importation of drugs, you know, critically impaired. So with less number of health facilities, no drugs and other supplies. And of course, that's why the numbers are, you know, as high as almost 5 million, 4.9 million people, you know, their access to basic health services across Sudan has been impaired.
Like, what about plaster for broken limbs and anesthetic for dealing with pain? Is any of that available?
The scarcity is really quite general. We are working, you know, hand in hand with UN agencies in particular, such as UNHCR, UNICEF, IOM, WFP, and others, are trying to our level best, you know, to reposition those supplies from UN agencies.
Hospitals have a sacred status in international law, but there's been detailed reporting on medical facilities in Sudan hit with mortars or other weapons during the war there. What have you and your staff witnessed?
Yeah, unfortunately, that's a case. That's a situation. Many of our frontline staff and obviously the communities are witnessing on a day-to-day basis. Now, just to give you one example of the dire situation, you know, the people of Sudan are going through. Saif, a male, 40 years old, resident of Khartoum, he was shot in the leg during the conflict in Khartoum on the 15th of April, 2023. Mm. And he had to flee to the nearby state, Gazira, which is 120 miles you know, southeast of Khartoum. And then he later developed complication and was admitted in the hospital of Gazira, and where he came under attack. Attacked by RSF, and the hospital he was in was attacked.
The rapid support forces. Yeah,
of course. Yeah, that's back in December. Saif had to walk 149 miles to Gedaref town, where he was able to get treatment.
Burhanu Awaka is the Sudan Country Director for Medical Teams International. An Indian man accused in a murder-for-hire plot pleaded not guilty in New York City today. The indictment says Nikhil Gupta was recruited by an unnamed Indian government employee to organize the assassination of a Sikh leader. The target, Gurpantwant Singh Panan, is a dual U.S.-Canadian citizen living in America. Panan is a Sikh separatist and considered a terrorist by the Indian government. Gupta was extradited Friday night from the Czech Republic and denies any involvement. In a similar case, Canada has accused the Indian government of having links to an assassination of a Sikh leader who was killed a year ago near Vancouver. India denied the accusations. The home of country music, the Grand Ole Opry in Nashville, is showcasing the ensemble American Patchwork Quartet later this month. The group's music definitely belongs to the tradition of Americana, but it's also a lot broader than that. Their take, for example, on the traditional gospel folk number, Wayfaring Stranger.
I'm just a poor wayfaring stranger, traveling through. Yet there's no toil, no threat, no danger in this world to which I go.
You're hearing the lead vocalist with American Patchwork Quartet, Falguni Shah. It is lovely to meet you. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
As I listen, Falu, to what you and American Patchwork Quartet do with Wayfaring Stranger, it strikes me that parts of the Indian classical vocal tradition and these traditional American songs are maybe surprisingly similar in feel and vibe. What did you hear and feel in this music the first time you heard it?
The beautiful thing that caught my attention about this music was its melodies. The melodies are so beautiful, catchy, and longing sometimes, even haunting. And when you have such a powerful set of melodies in so many songs, it's a universal language. I didn't have to do anything. It just spoke to my heart, literally, in the first play that Clay played it for me.
Clay Ross, yes. The guitarist with the American Patchwork Quartet.
Yes, he introduced so many songs, and it's music that goes from one heart to another.
Falu, your career is really varied. Born in Mumbai, studied in depth the classical vocal tradition with masters in India, then moved to New York, worked with the great percussionist Kersh Kale, doing the college dance circuit, soloed with Yo-Yo Ma on the Silk Road Project. Where do you see your current work with American Patchwork Quartet kind of sitting along your artistic path?
American Patchwork Quartet came at a most wonderful time. It's a music that is a fabric of our society. It enhances diversity, but it also keeps true to your roots and foundations. These melodies and songs have been passed on for generations, just like my music has been passed on to me for 11 generations. I don't see any difference between when I sing Wayfaring Stranger or a Bilawal Raga from India, because they are gorgeous melodies and ragas and scales that have been passed on. And it is our duty to make this a beautiful statement and pass it on to the next future generations, as well as spread the message of peace, unity, diversity, and acceptance.
Yeah, I mean, American Patchwork Quartet really embraces this American repertoire. And I guess it's a reminder that these sounds belong to all Americans, whether they've lived here for generations or just recently arrived. With that as the ensemble's North Star, I'm just curious how it feels to be taking the work of American Patchwork Quartet to this revered all-American venue, the Grand Ole Opry.
Oh my God, when we first got the call, Clay called me and I was doing a Carnegie Hall project that time. And I said, "What happened, Clay?" He said, "You won't believe this. You know, we are going to be debuting and we're going to be singing at Grand Ole Opry." I'm like, "Seriously? I came here 20 years ago, but I've never played there." So this was my chance of becoming one with the excitement of playing at this historic venue, at this gorgeous venue that every musician's dream is, and ours is coming true. And we are so happy that an Indian person, at least me, I'm happy that an Indian person is going to be going there and singing. And it is a magical moment that I tend to enjoy every minute of it.
So I want to go out, Falu, with your version of O Shenandoah, a traditional tune, origin unknown, lyrics focused on nature, a river. Where does your mind go when you sing O Shenandoah?
It is about going from one mountain to other and one river to other. So Shenandoah versus Ganga, both are rivers, both are beautiful. They both give you so much. And I feel like there is no difference between waters. There's no difference between human beings and music. So I feel connected to both.
Oh, Shenandoah, I am your daughter.
Falguni Shah is the lead vocalist for American Patchwork Quartet. The band will make their debut at the Grand Ole Opry tomorrow night. You're listening to The World. Hey there, a quick favor. We are conducting an audience survey, and we'd be really grateful if you could take just a few minutes and answer some questions in the survey. Please visit survey.prx.org/world to take the survey today. Again, that's survey.prx.org/world. And thank you. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. At a summit in Switzerland this weekend, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky addressed world leaders.
I sincerely wish that all of you, all the peoples of the world, every child, every family could simply live without war.
Leaders from nearly 100 countries gathered to discuss a pathway to peace in Ukraine. Russia was notably absent. It was not invited. China wasn't there either. The World's Daniel Offman is in Riga, Latvia. He's been following the summit. Give us a little more background here, Daniel. What was the purpose of this gathering?
Well, I'm going to start with what the summit wasn't about. The summit wasn't going to lead to any comprehensive peace agreement or peace plan. As we speak right now, Russia and Ukraine are still fighting, and there have been no signs that really either side is ready for a ceasefire. And on top of that, Russia wasn't invited to the summit. So the gathering in Switzerland was about something else. The idea was to bring as many countries as possible to find consensus over some common principles. And the framework for this summit was driven by Ukraine and some aspects from Volodymyr Zelensky's 10-point peace plan. And that plan is basically Ukraine's vision of how the war should end in a way that would guarantee its territorial integrity and security going forward.
Got it. So what elements of Zelensky's peace plan were at the top of the agenda? What was discussed?
So coming out of the summit, most of the countries signed a joint statement where they agreed to three main points: that any use of nuclear weapons is unacceptable, that food security shouldn't be weaponized in any way, and third, that all prisoners of war must be released in an exchange, and that all unlawfully detained Ukrainian civilians should return back to Ukraine. So these are some pretty basic principles, but all three of them reflect the reality of the war in Ukraine right now. Russian officials often mention the country's nuclear capabilities as an intimidation tactic. Russia has targeted Ukrainian ports and grain silos, which has damaged food security across the world. And Russia has been accused of unlawfully deporting and detaining Ukrainians, including Ukrainian children. So there's a lot of disagreement worldwide when it comes to a pathway forward in resolving the war in Ukraine, but there seems to be some consensus around these points.
So this is a pretty substantial audience of world leaders. What else did Zelensky have to say to them?
Well, there was one important theme that Zelensky and some U.S. officials spoke about during the summit. Here's what he had to say.
I'm proud that all parts of the world, all continents, are now represented at the peace summit. We have managed to avoid one of the most terrible things, namely the division of the world into opposing blocs.
So right there, Zelensky is making the case that the world is united around Ukraine and its vision for peace. And that's been a point of emphasis both in Russia and Ukraine. Both countries have tried to make the case that they have global support, especially from countries in the Middle East, Africa, and Asia. But not all countries, even among those in attendance, signed on to the final statement. So most notably, Mexico, India, Saudi Arabia, Brazil, South Africa, all of these countries didn't sign on.
Yeah, why was that the case?
Well, each one of these countries has its own motivations, but one thing that all of them share in common is that they maintain some level of economic relations with Russia. Mm. So these countries don't want to spoil those economic or even diplomatic relationships, and they maintain their current positions by sort of walking the line. So they participate in the political process, like going to the summit, while not fully supporting Russia or Ukraine.
So we mentioned that Russia was not included in the peace summit. Not surprising, perhaps, but how do you think that shaped the conversation?
So on Friday, just a day before the summit began in Switzerland, President Vladimir Putin met with officials at the Russian Ministry of Foreign Affairs, and he spelled out his conditions for negotiations with Ukraine. Here's what he said.
Українські війська должны быть повністю виведені із Донецької, Луганської народних республік.
So he says here that as soon as Ukrainian troops leave four Ukrainian territories that Russia illegally annexed and commit to not joining the NATO military alliance in the future, Russia would stop hostilities and come to the negotiating table. So this statement from Putin is really more of a demand than a call for peace. But despite that, in the final statement coming out of the summit, there's a line that says, reaching peace requires the involvement of and dialogue between all parties. So there is an acknowledgement that a future pathway to peace is only possible with Russia's participation.
The World's Daniel Hoffman there, reporting from Riga, Latvia. A punch in the jaw that hurts the drug lords. That's how a German state justice minister described a massive cocaine bust today in Dusseldorf. Investigators there said they seized 39 tons of cocaine worth $2.7 billion, making it the biggest ever cocaine haul in the country. The cocaine was actually seized last year, but authorities just announced it after the recent arrest of seven suspects. They're accused of transporting by sea from Latin America to Europe 10 shipping containers with large quantities of cocaine hidden among vegetables and fruit. German State Justice Minister Benjamin Limbach hailed the interception of the drugs, saying, "This is a blow to international organized criminality." In a diplomatic shakeup, and it is diplomacy, China is recalling a couple of its envoys to Australia. Not the highest ranking ones, but certainly the most famous. Wang Wang and Fu Ni, the giant pandas at the Adelaide Zoo, are going home. They'll be replaced with a younger, more fertile pair. China's Premier Li Qiang made the announcement during a state visit to Australia.
We will provide a new pair of equally beautiful, lovely, and adorable
pandas
to the Adelaide.
As long as no one's getting shortchanged on adorableness, the humans involved seem happy. But from the point of view of the pandas, is this really fair? Wang Wang and Fu Ni have lived in Adelaide for 15 years. Beijing loaned them to the zoo in 2009 after China and Australia inked a landmark trade deal.
Buy gas, get pandas free. President Hu's promised a breeding pair for Adelaide Zoo with the hope babies will come in 2012.
So, I believe that this will certainly become a new symbol of our friendship.
But babies never came, and not for lack of trying.
It's spring, and love is in the air at Adelaide Zoo. Well, hopefully.
It seems giant pandas prefer eating and sleeping to making babies.
Adult pandas are becoming more sedentary and less interested in sex.
Another problem, male pandas don't know what they're doing.
So this year, whilst we saw some attempted matings, unfortunately at the point where it was really critical, they couldn't get the things where they needed to get going in the right place.
Zookeepers have tried helping Wang Wang and Fu Ni with lighting and alone time.
Keepers have closed their exhibit for 2 weeks to give Wang Wang and Fu Ni some privacy during breeding season.
They called in giant panda sex experts from China. They started Wang Wang on an exercise regimen.
He's doing some squats and some crab training just to really give him that endurance and also to build up some of that muscle condition ahead of the activities to come.
In the end, nothing worked. So after all of that, it's back to China for Wang Wang and Fu Ni. Out with the old, in with the new. Their replacements have yet to be appointed. More global news and stories are still coming your way this hour. You're listening to The World. Getting Israeli Jews and Palestinians to see things from each other's point of view has always been hard. Now, even a self-proclaimed oasis of peace can't sidestep the fault lines of conflict.
Each side lost so much during October 7th and in Gaza after October 7th.
But they are still trying. That's coming up here on The World. You're with The World. I'm Marco Werman. U.S. Envoy Amos Hochstein is in Israel trying to tamp down the growing conflict on the country's northern border, where Israel and Hezbollah have been stepping up their exchange of rocket fire for nearly 9 months. Speaking to the Carnegie Endowment last month, Hochstein said he does not believe either side wants all-out war, but that doesn't mean it can't happen.
What I worry about every single day is that a miscalculation or an accident, an errant missile hits a bus full of children, that could force the political system in either country to retaliate in a way that slides us into war.
Benjamin Netanyahu also dissolved his war cabinet last night. Not surprising, perhaps, given the announcement last week from Benny Gantz, a centrist who joined Netanyahu's cabinet in a show of unity after October 7th.
B'tzari,
In his resignation speech there, Gantz said the prime minister lacks both vision and justification for this war. And another new development, Israel's military announced over the weekend that it would stop fighting in southern Gaza during daytime hours. The tactical pause applies to about 7.5 miles of road in the Rafah area. It's not the ceasefire the international community has been demanding, and it isn't the hard line the Israeli far right wants either. But the army says the pause will continue until further notice. UNICEF spokesperson James Elder has been traveling through central and northern Gaza in recent days. This morning I caught up with him in Rafah and asked him whether a daily pause in fighting around parts of the city would make a difference.
Oh, Marco, look, any pause in bombardment's good for children. It's hard to overstate the ferocity of these attacks that continue 250 days in. I'm just back from a hospital. I'm just back again from seeing a host of children missing limbs, a little girl who's blind, night after night after night. This continues. So the tiniest limitation in bombing is a good thing for children. And yes, of course, we need to be able to bring more aid in, but we also need to be able to deliver it safely inside the Gaza Strip. And of course, it is the responsibility, legal responsibility of the occupying power, Israel, to not just allow it in, but to facilitate it safely across the Gaza Strip. And that has not been happening. And rather than more routes, we're losing them. Rafah, where you said I am, Rafah has been the humanitarian lifeline for aid coming into the Gaza Strip. We have not seen humanitarian aid coming through Rafah since the 7th of May.
So I know you're in Rafah today. Talk about where you've been in Gaza. I'm specifically curious about the city of Deir al-Balah and what the situation was there. Like, is there food in the markets and is there water flowing from the usual taps and spigots?
In the north, it's dire. The north is cut off. UNRWA, for example, is the largest, you know, the backbone of aid, has not been allowed to lead a convoy to the north since January. You know, you can't overstate the restrictions, the blockages and denials of aid. But in the south, there is more food in the markets. There is no money. Either people can't access their money because you can't access from a bank, or of course, you know, employment has been shattered. Water, absolutely not. There is a lethal lack of water, as bad as I've ever seen. Just went past, as I was driving from one hospital to another, you know, saw a truck just finish and run out of water in a queue of 100 people, children with buckets. Like, okay, so that was a queue. I queued up for 3 hours and I can't get water. So the lack of water, the threat to dehydration, the risk of disease. Yeah, people here get to shower once a week, once every 2 weeks, if you queue all day. No, there is an utterly, utterly lethal lack of water on the Gaza Strip. And that's despite UNICEF managing to keep a desalination plant functioning just with the fuel we're allowed.
Israel has said in the past that it has allowed trucks carrying aid into Gaza, but that it's the UN that is failing to distribute the aid. How do you respond?
In May, with the needs rapidly increasing and the situation of children rapidly decreasing, half the number of humanitarian trucks came into Gaza than in April. None have come in the Rafah crossing since May. The pier is no longer functional. I'm sorry for the frustration of my voice, but we've been doing this for months and months, and from the highest levels, from the Secretary General, all the way to dashboards showing how many trucks are coming in. The evidence is clear. Of course, it's very difficult for those outside because journalists are banned from being here. If journalists could come, they could see the devastation this is wreaking on children. And secondly, they could see that aid is being consistently, systematically restricted.
James Elder, you've been outspoken on behalf of children in Gaza. I mean, you are, after all, with UNICEF. What have you witnessed, though, and what specifically have you been trying to call people's attention to?
It's wildly disconcerting to hear the justifications as to why these horrors on children can continue, how people are seemingly able to overlook and dismiss the killing of so many children and be so disturbingly comfortable not to have a ceasefire, these horrors and attacks on children and hostages not going home, and people seem okay with that. So I think for me that as we now talk about 15,000 children reportedly killed. I mean, today I was in a hospital just a few hours ago, Marco, and I met Hala, who was 4, who's been blinded when her home was struck. Yassim, who's 11, who's lost 2 limbs when he was asleep in his home, which was struck. Wahid, who's lost his right arm and his right leg when he was asleep at 5 a.m. and his home was struck. I've got hundreds of these examples now. I didn't imagine the world would allow it to continue. Gaza has lost so much, but everyone's lost. You know, our shared humanity surely has lost as these horrors continue.
Journalists are not allowed into Gaza to document what's happening. You've been, James, to regions of central and northern Gaza that are really isolated by fighting. What are conditions like in central and northern Gaza compared to Rafah, where you are, where there is more visibility and access from outsiders?
It's children just walking through rubble as far as the eye can see. And often I will go through with a colleague who's from that area, and they might not have seen Gaza City or Jabalia in the north since it happened. And they're in tears because they are looking at hotels and beach cafes. They're looking at their city, their home, utterly, either their home in terms of an area or literally their home destroyed. And they're in shock at this. Then, yeah, it's certainly like nothing I've seen in my two decades with the United Nations.
I'm hearing in your voice, James, just what a harrowing visit this one has been. What would a daily pause in fighting do to address those really profound issues? I'm guessing that it would have to be something much more comprehensive than a pause.
Yeah, it would have to be a daily pause across the entire Gaza Strip as well. The one that's been announced is a tiny access point of aid. It solves the problem of getting aid in there, which is a small issue. It does not solve the problem of getting aid across the Gaza Strip or of opening more crossings. It certainly doesn't solve the problem of, you know, where I am or within the miles of this, if it being bombed tonight, as it surely will, or this afternoon. But as a colleague said to me just recently, Gaza, like, even a month, just let us breathe. So a ceasefire is hostages home, is Gazans getting a moment to breathe, and, yeah, is parents promising their children you will wake up tomorrow morning.
James Elder is a spokesperson for UNICEF. He spoke to us today from Rafah in southern Gaza. Some 8 months after the Hamas attacks on Israeli communities, tensions in Israel are at a breaking point. Coming to any kind of shared perspective on what's happening in Gaza can feel impossible. Some say part of the problem is that you rarely find Jews and Arabs living in the same neighborhoods, and because of that, they don't have regular contact in daily life. For decades, though, one community has been working to change that, with current conditions putting their experiment to the test. Reporter Sarah Ventry takes us to the Oasis of Peace.
Looking out over the Ayalon Valley, you see sweeping green hills and neatly planted rows of crops and flat fields. And nestled in that valley is a no man's land, in between Israel and the occupied West Bank. Inside that no man's land is the Oasis of Peace. On the surface, the goal is simple.
Arab and Jewish families who intentionally came and want to try to live together without killing each other. This is the reality of this land. Between the river and the sea, there are two people.
Samah Salaime is the co-director of the education institutions here at Wahat al-Salam, or Neve Shalom. She says she moved to the village in October 2000, after the start of the Second Intifada.
So in many ways, you know, this was perfect timing, you know, to take my family and to find a place here and leaving, you know, the burning Jerusalem behind.
On the ground, this looks like Arab and Jewish neighbors living next door to each other. Signs in both Arabic and Hebrew, a bilingual, bicultural school on site. But it also means being part of difficult conversations, uncomfortable moments, and struggle. Especially now, after October 7th.
We have community members who lost their friends family members in Gaza. We have Jewish members, and including myself. I'm not Jewish. I have friends in the south. My friend Vivian Silver was killed, and people, we know them, like in the peace community, they were kidnapped or killed. We have a family member in Wahat al-Salam Neve Shalom. She lost 70 people, 70 family members.
Fear, anger, disappointment, concern, you know, all those feelings, that's what hit us.
Eldad Jaffe is the chair of the local council in the village, kind of like a mayor. He actually started his term on October 7th. He says within a week, the village started organizing meetings for community members to talk through what was happening.
At the beginning, we met Jews separately and Palestinians separately. To ventilate, to talk, to try and understand what are we going through. So we had two of those kind of meetings within a week, and then the third meeting, already we met together, and we had all in all, you know, in the last 8 months, we had eight of those kind of meetings. It didn't create a separation. It didn't split us apart. But it was hard for us to talk.
Jaffe says it was hard because at the beginning, there was a sense that Palestinian community members couldn't identify with the feelings of Jewish community members. Then as the war progressed, there was a feeling that Jews couldn't identify with the feelings of Palestinians. This is Samah Salimeh again.
This village is an ongoing project of education for peace, and it takes time. You know, how you say in English, it's take a village to...
It takes a village to raise a child, yeah.
So it's take one peaceful village to raise a child who believes in peace.
Souf Ben Yishai is one of those children who was raised in this village.
We have, in the past few months, gone through the process of erasement and reconciliation in our own village, that each side that lost so much during October 7th and in Gaza after October 7th, they both came together and expressed their grief, their pain, their unbearable loss and suffering.
The people who choose to live in this village are unique. They've decided that they want to live in an intentional community, in a different kind of society than the one the rest of the country lives in. And even though this place is self-selective, full of people who want peace and are ready to do the work to make it happen, Tsuf's mom, Ariella Ben Yishai, says it's still really, really hard.
People think it might be just an easy thing to talk about it, to give flowers to each other. They have a very idealistic view of what it is to have chosen to live together, but they should expect to have it be complex. They should expect to have conflictual issues and to know that these discussions, like the discussions we were having since the war began here, the dialogues, are going to be difficult conversations.
And for many, it's never been more important to have those conversations.
We already know where this path leads. This land bore both of us, and if we don't know how to treat it ourselves and each other well, it will swallow us together.
For the world, I'm Sarah Ventry, Jerusalem.
America is not being invaded. There is no foreign army gathering on the southern border preparing for an attack. But if you're listening to some of the political rhetoric here in the U.S., it is the sort of perception you might come away with. As the November election approaches, the language around immigration is getting more and more extreme. From KPBS in San Diego, Gustavo Solis has this report.
This is an invasion of people not wanting to follow the rules for immigration.
That is State Assembly candidate Carl DeMaio in May telling a local news anchor that there's an invasion at the border. It's the talking point that Republicans across the country are using more and more as we head into the November election. Not only does DeMaio say there's an invasion, he also tells us what's behind it.
Because Democrats want the votes, they have no problem with a porous border.
Experts say this interview, without any pushback from the news anchor, is an example of why invasion rhetoric is so dangerous. Zachary Mueller is the senior research director at America's Voice, a pro-immigrant advocacy organization. He says invasion rhetoric is part of a white supremacy conspiracy theory in which
elite liberals are part of this cabal to bring in non-white immigrants to replace white folks, to replace their voting power, and to steal elections and undermine democracy. Now, obviously, none of that is true.
This kind of language ramped up in 2016, but it has a long history in California. In 1873, the San Francisco Chronicle published an advertisement warning of a Chinese invasion, asking readers, what are you going to do about it? Political cartoons from the 1880s show California as a sinking ship falling under the weight of too many Chinese migrants. Natalia Molina is a professor at UC San Diego. She studies the construct of race in the United States.
The use of the term invasion and just the general idea of it isn't anything new in terms of how we describe immigrants, how we frame immigration issues. It goes back as far back as the late 19th century.
Molina says anti-Chinese sentiment led to the Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882, essentially banning immigration from China. U.S. history is full of examples of anti-immigrant rhetoric leading to discriminatory laws. Molina uses this 1994 ad as an example. It's from California Governor Pete Wilson advocating for a measure that would strip benefits from undocumented immigrants.
They keep coming. 2 million illegal immigrants in California.
The federal government won't stop them at the border.
Molina says that framing the problem as immigrants invading is counterproductive. It doesn't help find real solutions to the broken immigration system.
And so how you define a problem defines a solution. If you define it as an invasion, well, then it's a matter of, you know, putting up a wall and making America strong.
She says immigration is such a complex topic that oversimplifying it distracts policymakers from asking nuanced questions.
How do we encourage legal immigration? Is our system set up even for legal immigration? At what level do we want immigration? What are the processes?
In 2020, more than $50 million was spent on anti-immigrant campaign ads. That amount more than quadrupled in 2022. And now, the 2024 election is already on pace to surpass that amount, according to data from America's Voice. Mueller says that these ads pull on people's genuine concerns about immigration.
Because it is a story that hits on their anxieties about who they are and their identity, about safety and their community's safety. It hits on, you know, concerns about, you know, their economic security and pulling on those anxieties, which are legitimate anxieties, racializing them, saying immigrants are to blame for that.
Voters around the country should be expected to be bombarded with more invasion ads before the November election.
We can't rely on ads because the ads are designed to be inflammatory. The ads are designed to get your attention for 30 seconds.
Molina's advice, do your own research.
We can't rely on a flyer or somebody who wants to win an election.
For the world, I'm Gustavo Solis.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. When a major earthquake rocked Ishikawa Prefecture in Japan, one of the hardest hit towns was Wajima, known for a style of lacquerware called Wajima Nuri. After the earthquake, people fled and the community that produced the lacquerware dispersed, putting livelihoods in peril, not to mention identity. Hannah Kirshner reports from the town of Yamanaka.
Rabia Gebler touches a blade to a fast-spinning piece of wood on a lathe. Shavings fly off in ribbons, and the wood takes the shape of a bowl, the kind used for miso soup. Gebler is German and came to Yamanaka about 2 years ago to study the town's specific style of wood turning.
It's in the mountains. Yamanaka means in the middle of the mountains, so there's a lot of wood.
For hundreds of years, Yamanaka artisans have been turning that wood into tableware and teaware. Sometimes the wood turners apply a finish themselves, but often their products become a canvas for artisans from Wajima, north of here on the Noto Peninsula. In Wajima, lacquer specialists apply urushi, which is lacquer made from the sap of urushi trees. Making one piece of Wajima nuri can take 5 craftspeople and more than 100 steps.
So you'll have someone making the base material, you'll have someone doing the base coats, the middle coats and the top coats, and then even a person for the sanding in between.
Wow. Yeah. The result is a shiny, opaque lacquer, usually black or red. And then on top of that, sometimes another craftsperson will apply makie. Makie is this painstaking process of painting detailed illustrations with urushi and sprinkling gold powder onto the design. Tiny bits of pearlescent shell or iridescent insect wings are used too. Imagine making a mosaic from individual pieces of glitter. Ayano Konishi is a makie artist who had her studio in Wajima until the earthquake. Her studio was attached to a family lacquerware shop that had been in business for about 250 years. The shop was on the same street as Wajima's famous morning market, where vendors sell fish and produce. And all along that street are lacquerware shops and studios. On December 31st, as usual, our shop was open, Konishi tells me. I took my children for a walk, and we went to the vegetable auntie to buy mandarin oranges and fruits. Everyone greeted us, and the children had a lot of fun. But on New Year's Day, everything would change in Wajima. Konishi and her family were relaxing at their apartment just outside of town.
本当にアパートももう。
There was a tremendous shaking. I really thought the apartment was going to collapse. I really thought we would die, says Konishi. Aftershocks kept coming, and in downtown Wajima, a fire broke out.
地震の影響で地盤が上がってしまって、水がどこにもなかったんですね。川の水も。
The earthquake caused the ground to rise, so there was no water anywhere, says Konishi. Pipes broke, and the river and fire cisterns drained. So firefighters couldn't draw water. Wajima's morning market and all the lacquerware shops and studios around it burned. 6 months later, much of Wajima is still uninhabitable. Craftspeople have scattered around the country, going to stay with relatives or in temporary housing. Some Wajima craftspeople have given up, especially the older ones. But one couple in their 70s tells me they are determined to continue. Kazuya and Kasumi Shirota are both makie artisans like Konishi. After the earthquake, their son urged them to come stay with him in Hyogo Prefecture, far away. I thought, I'm already old, so if I go to my son's place, I'll become senile, says Kazuya Shirota. Kasumi wanted to continue doing makie too. A lacquerware craftsman called them from Yamanaka Onsen, the wood-turning town. He invited them to come right away and promised to help them start working again. I meet the Shirotas at the apartment complex where they now live in Yamanaka, and we sit around the table where they work. Kazuya Shirota makes these incredibly ornate designs on ceremonial objects, things to be used in Buddhist temples or during tea ceremony. He shows me an incense box decorated with a hen and a rooster.
I just can't get over how detailed and lifelike the chickens are on this incense box.
Their feathers were painted one by one, textured with tiny lines.
There's like 7 different sizes of gold flakes on this.
The Shirotas tell me they wish they could return to Wajima. They can get money from the government to tear down their damaged house, but they would have to rebuild at their own expense. It could take years. At 70, they don't think it's realistic. As for Ayano Konishi, who had her studio near Wajima's morning market, she also ended up in Yamanaka, just a few doors down in the same apartment complex. When I visit, she still hasn't set up her workspace, so we sit around the kitchen table. Her older son is home from preschool with a fever. He sits in her lap with a juice box while she shows me how she sprinkles gold powder by flicking a small bamboo tube with a mesh end. Tools are often passed down from parent to child or teacher to student. Some of these tools you can no longer buy. Konishi explains that even when she bought tools, she modified them to suit her. She lost so many tools in the fire, and she wishes she could get them back. There's been an outpouring of support for Wajima artisans. Craftspeople from all over Japan have sent tools. Crowdfunding campaigns received donations from around the world. Because of all that attention, the Wajima artisans who can work are busier than ever. And in turn, Yamanaka woodturners are busy making wooden bases for them.
So,
we are aiming to return to Wajima eventually, Konishi says. But it will take years to clear the rubble and rebuild. For as long as she lives in Yamanaka, she wants to get inspiration from her new environment. Her work draws from nature and is also influenced by the people she collaborates with. She recently ordered some wooden bases from a craftsman she met here in Yamanaka. Earthquakes are part of life in Japan, and the crafts we see as traditional now were shaped by historic events, by natural resources, and the movement of people. If more Wajima artisans start working in Yamanaka, these two towns and their crafts may become even more interconnected. Some craftspeople are hopeful that will strengthen both traditions, and they will continue to evolve. For The World, I'm Hannah Kirshner, Yamanaka.
The World is a co-production of GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. I'm Marco Werman. Join us right back here tomorrow.